Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, a five-star showing from Erling Haaland as Manchester City make it through to the quarterfinals of the Champions League with a 7-0 thrashing of RB Leipzig. Just how good can he get? We'll also be talking about Trent Alexander-Arnold's future at right-back after Liverpool's exit at the hands of Real Madrid. We'll talk about the draw for the last eight, which includes three sides from Italy. Can they cause a shock in this year's competition? And we'll discuss the greatest performances on the European stage. This is The Game. This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, a five-star showing from Erling Haaland as Manchester City make it through to the quarterfinals of the Champions League with a 7-0 thrashing of RB Leipzig. Just how good can he get? We'll also be talking about Trent Alexander-Arnold's future at right-back after Liverpool's exit at the hands of Real Madrid. We'll talk about the draw for the last eight, which includes three sides from Italy. Can they cause a shock in this year's competition? And we'll discuss the greatest performances on the European stage. This is The Game. Hello, welcome again to The Game Podcast. I'm Hugh Wisencroft, alongside Gregor Robertson, Ian Hawkey and Jonathan Northcroft, discussing a big week in terms of European football. But where do we begin? Well, obviously, we begin with a man named Erling Braut Haaland, who has defied the odds and, to be perfectly honest, is currently making fantasy look like reality, shifting the conversation and the whole football universe into a totally new paradigm. Manchester City swept past RB Leipzig 7-0 in the second leg at the Emirates to reach the Champions League quarterfinals, and Haaland became the fastest and the youngest player to reach 30 goals in Europe's elite club competition. He's also the youngest player to score five times in a single Champions League game, joining, of course, the great Lionel Messi, but also Brazil forward Luis Adriano is the only other players to do so. He's only 22 years old, by the way, and he is on 39 goals in all competitions for the season. He's the first City player to do that in a single campaign. He's got five hat-tricks this season. That is three more than any other player in the big five leagues. And the one thing that I wanted to talk to you guys about is, in an era where we've had so many false nines, is Erling Haaland going to make the genuine number nine fashionable again? What is making him so great? Jonathan?
Probably talked about this before, but it's that sense of the guy that's almost been built in a lab to create the sort of ideal number nine. And it's not just the physical prowess, but it's the positional intelligence, the number of times he gets into those right areas. And this playing for a team where he's had to adjust his style. So when he played for Dortmund, he was able to get on the end of different sorts of moves, much more counter-attacking moves. But you see real intelligence of movement. And then maybe the biggest thing of all is actually his mentality and his appetite. It's that desire, that determination to score again. And it's also that ability to shrug off missing chances and the negatives. And I saw him at Crystal Palace at the weekend. There were two moments where he looked absolutely useless, when he ballooned a header, he scooped a finish over the bar. He still scored the winning goal, albeit from the spot. And it just didn't affect him. It didn't seem to matter to him that he'd missed these chances. He was back for more in that particular game. And then he goes and performs like he did on Tuesday night. There's that sense of unstoppability about him physically, but also mentally. He's just not satisfied no matter how much he scores.
He is insatiable. Absolutely right. Ian, have you seen anything like this. Are you one of those that maybe takes it with a pinch of salt, or do you just revel in the fact that Haaland is doing what he's doing?
No, I think it's a joy in it. So I think we should enjoy it, and I think he is doing. I mean, he's clearly doing something quite unique for certainly a player of his generation. And I agree with Johnny. You cannot help but be impressed with his sort of studiousness, his cleverness in making the right runs, being in the right places, and the patience that goes with that as well. We've talked quite a lot about the periods when he's not touching the ball, when he's not receiving the ball. And you have to have the right attitude to be able to deal with that, not let it affect you, move on to the next thing. I also really liked the other night his claiming responsibility. I forget which broadcaster he spoke to, but he did the rounds. And he said, it was something like, you have to read between the lines. City have won 4 of the last 5 Premier Leagues. They didn't buy me for that, so they bought me for the Champions League. You know, that's saying this is on me, and I'm up to it, and I want to be the person who breaks that glass ceiling.
You make such a figure out of him. It's about more than just scoring goals. He has a higher purpose, Erling Haaland. I like it. What he's doing is quite incredible, Gregor. When you were watching this game, it's not really bullying. I mean, it's not fair to call it that, but he seems to provide on certain occasions such a danger in front of goal, such a high level of either finishing or just being in the right place, or just, you know, at times unplayable. Even an early chance that he had in the game, which didn't go in the back of the net, you just saw that he was really up for it. And when he's really on his game, there can be no stopping him unless, I guess, as has been alluded to by many, many others, unless Manchester City just don't provide him with the service that he needs. But on this occasion, the ball was in the right place, he was in the right place, and it ended up in the back of the net on 5 occasions. And it was just silly to watch at times, I think.
Yeah, it's almost jarring. It's like something about how spontaneous and almost like aggressive he is. Even when the ball drops at his feet, and you know, drops in his vicinity, he's lashing the ball home. It's like really impactful. And he's like, that's probably something about his gargantuan frame and his massive levers and his strides and his power. I think that's the word that sums him up, his power. You know, that's one part of it. I completely agree with what the guys are saying about he's obviously fiercely intelligent as well. Like his interviews are becoming more and more sort of, he's really engaging to listen to as well. He's talking about how the speed of thought in his mind is his. You know, Julian Lescott, I think it was, asked him, you know, what's your super strength? And it kind of almost put him on his back foot. He's like, well, you know, I would say after scoring 5 goals, it's goals. that's obviously my strength. But then he went on to say that it's about the speed of thought. He's sort of not, in fact, almost not having to think. And that's what you see when you see the ball fall close to him. There's no thought, there's no fear, there's no, am I gonna hit this in that corner or in that corner? It's just whack. Yeah, absolutely, it's just so instinctive. So that's the thing that's really, you know, really incredible to watch, I think, coupled with his power and the way, you know, as has been said, I think for the second goal, he hounded and harried, won the ball back, and then he was there to stick in the header after De Bruyne's shot. Remarkable, remarkable. And some of the stats as well, like we've heard some of them, but I read somewhere that it's taken him 19 games to score 4 Premier League hat-tricks, and Ruud van Nistelrooy was the next quickest to 4 in 65 games. He's had a total of 623 touches in the Premier League, meaning he scored 1 goal in every 22 touches. So we've spoken about that all season, how few touches he has in games. But if you're scoring a goal every 22 touches of the ball, it's, you know, I think ultimately end of the season, it's not going to matter.
It's interesting you mentioned Ruud van Nistelrooy there, because I think he was maybe the last of an age of a centre-forward, particularly in the Premier League, who was just about scoring goals. Maybe Jamie Vardy as well. But essentially what I'm saying is, so many number nines that we've seen of recent times, maybe since Didier Drogba, have to have an all-round game. And we've seen so many strikers, you know, needing to lead the line on their own. You know, the one up front means that you need to have a bigger range, if you like, of assets. You know, you can't just be a goal scorer. And that, I guess, was pointed at Haaland when he first came. Oh, is he going to link play? You know, is he doing enough of that? You know, and then of course you got everyone saying, has he made Manchester City worse? Of course, which I think we've now fully got an answer to. The answer clearly being no. But I can't think of an era where you know, we were recently talking about a lack of genuine number nines, you know, top tier number nines. People were saying there's a handful. They weren't even putting Harry Kane or Romelu Lukaku in the top bracket, the top tier of number nines. And those of us of a certain age, you know, we're talking about just England alone having 6 30-goal strikers, you know, not being able to fit them all in the squad, let alone in the team. You know, it was just, I know it was a different era of football, but what I'm saying is number nines who were just about scoring goals seemed very common. And I'm not trying to take away from Haaland's game, but he seems to be a throwback. He seems to be a number nine who is just all about putting the ball in the back of the net, not worrying about too much else. And I'm now thinking about what the playgrounds will be like, Jonathan, and whether it will be all about, you know, being like Haaland, you know, players that just care desperately about smashing the ball into the back of the net. And I personally think that would be a great thing for football. No more false nines. I'm in that party.
No, I think he does connect with kids, Hugh. It's funny, I've got two girls and they're of that, you know, nine, they're 8 and 10, and they're of that sort of generation where I mean, kids follow individuals as much as teams. And the players that interest them are Haaland, Rashford, maybe Harry Kane a little bit, but it's the younger ones. It's the I don't know, it's that ability to, there's something childlike about Erling Haaland. He will inspire people to you know, youngsters to sort of focus a little bit differently on what they want to be. And a couple of things come to mind. One, speaking to some of the lads that were on Man City's pre-season tour and got to watch training a little bit, and they said they were watching the Rondos. And Haaland was hopeless. He was absolutely useless, to the point that the other players are kind of laughing at how poor he was at those exercises. And yet, you know, finishing drills and on the pitch, unbelievable, completely different. So he's just such an un-Guardiola player, of course. And then Guardiola on Saturday at Crystal Palace was saying that he wants to be remembered as the coach that made Haaland the better footballer, the broader footballer. Which I thought was an interesting thing for him to say, because although it, on the one hand it sort of suggests I still want him to be my type of player, I think there was a tacit part to that where Pep was also saying the thing that he's really good at, I'm not meddling with that, I'm not changing that, you know, I just want to round him in other ways, but, you know, I've bought him for this thing that he's brilliant at, and that's what he's going to keep doing, and if I can add little bits around the side, I'll have done my job. And we're talking about a player that's 22 and they're so young, but history tells us, or experience tells us, that as strikers move through their 20s, they score more and more and more. So, you know, I'm not the first person to say this, but you just wonder where it's going to stop, Haaland, in terms of numbers and all that kind of stuff.
It's great for football in a way that he's picked up, you know, I hate to say it, as many social media channels and as many TV channels as try and force the Al Nassr highlights down my throat. To be perfectly honest, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo's era is over, and it's good to see someone picking up the mantle in the shape of Erling Haaland. And what I mean is, in football, you know, you think about Lionel Messi as well and when he might stop, but you're thinking about going to the ground and hoping to witness something, you know, beyond exceptional. You know, and that was it with Messi and Ronaldo. People would show up, you know, witnessing greatness, almost wanting to go home with a story that they talk about, you know, for the next 30 or 40 years. And they can say, I went to see this player once and he did this, you know, incredible thing, whatever it might be, score 5 goals. And it's good to see Haaland immediately fill that void. And, you know, like I say, what he's doing is incredible. But it was actually interesting after the game to see so many people saying, wow, he's moving into the kind of numbers that Messi and Ronaldo put up for years. You know, it was a weird kind of juxtaposition because it felt like you were seeing something special. And even, you know, I've already mentioned Messi's name on the podcast. He scored 5 goals in a Champions League game. And you're thinking, wow, okay, Haaland's done it too. What will the future hold for him? You know, and it was an exceptional performance and it was kind of jaws on the floor at times. And the only thing that was annoying for me, Ian, was Pep Guardiola making him come off after 5, because I was like, come on, 6, the double hat trick in a Champions League knockout game, that would be ridiculous. So just tell me why you think Pep Guardiola is such a party pooper, because he says he's got to leave his young striker with a target. I'd hate that if I was Haaland.
I don't know. Apparently he's had his heart broken by Julia Roberts. So maybe he was in a
jilted. Yeah, totally jilted. Yeah.
Well, I would say that Pep
comes out of Tuesday night looking quite a canny man manager, not necessarily for the Haaland decision, but for actually quite, you know, quite, I would say more than likely criticizing Kevin De Bruyne before the game and then watching Kevin De Bruyne be the most magnificent Kevin De Bruyne that we know. So, you know, I think if Pep was trying to motivate, just stimulate the Haaland hunger, then, you know, he was acting according to his own confident interest for his own confidence in his motivational skills for seeing De Bruyne react so well to a little slight, to a little denial of praise, denial of opportunity.
Yes, Ian, okay, that's an interesting view. Gregor, listen, we spoke about a 7-0 recently. I won't mention who was involved in that. I don't want to relive the past. But I did say on that previous podcast that if any team is to win 7-0, then the opposition have to play a big part in that. So as great as it was for Erling Haaland, and, you know, people say I throw negativity in all the time, but RB Leipzig played a part in this as well, didn't they? So did they just play into Manchester City's hands tactically? What went wrong for them on the night?
Yeah, I mean, they were awful. The goalkeeper, Yanis Blaswich in particular, was just woeful with the ball at his feet. And, you know, it's one of those where you understand that they want to build play from the back and they want to, you know, get the goalkeeper trying to pick out midfielders or clip it to the fullbacks, but if he's not good enough doing it, you know, I don't see them every week. Maybe he is and he had an off day, but it just invited City onto them in waves and waves. And Pep Guardiola spoke quite openly actually afterwards about some of his decisions about playing Silva on the right to kind of, because he felt that Leipzig's left-hand side, Guardiola and Raum were really strong, and that was an area in the first game where they kind of they got out quite too easily, particularly in the second half. And he thinks that Silva's one of the most sort of intelligent players at pressing and knowing when to press and knowing how to kind of close off angles in European football, he said, really. He said there's no other player like Silva at that. So I think, and as Ian alluded to, his kind of motivation of De Bruyne, I think we saw that. So it was certainly an interesting night for Guardiola, and everything went right. But you have to say Leipzig were shocking. Just to continue playing that way, even after they'd gone 2 or 3 goals behind, was just madness in my view. So, look, we've got to say as well, as much as this was an incredible night, and they're just beating the team were third in the German Bundesliga, 7-0 in the Champions League, the round of 16. I'm not entirely sure how healthy that is either. Look, it was a one-off night maybe, but they swept them aside, and I think they scored 6 against them in a past meeting as well at the Etihad. So we've spoken a lot about the Super League and whether it's already here in the Premier League, and this was another piece of evidence to suggest it might be.
Ian, do you agree with that?
Yes, yeah, I do. I mean, Leipzig they really capitulated, didn't they? And they had no answers. And as Gregor said, their plan A, which is to build from the back. Once that was stymied, they really had no answers. And you could actually see, particularly with Guardiola, just the confidence draining from him at the end. And, you know, this is a really fine player who has been, you know, at the peak of his powers recently. But there are nights when City can do that to opposition, just leave them utterly bewildered and without answers. I would say, and they, you know, they didn't use this as an excuse, the penalty was a pretty dispiriting start for them. And you know, I think they were slightly justified in thinking that it was very, very soft indeed. And then, you know, once City were 1-0 up, then boom, that was it.
Are they favourites? Did they send a message, Manchester City, about who might win this Champions League? Because for a lot of people, there's been no standout, Johnny. We know what Manchester City are capable of. They've shown us that in this game, but they haven't exactly played that way throughout the season. So I wonder if maybe they're going up a gear for the Champions League. Maybe this is a sign that they're putting more emphasis on that competition.
Yeah, they've actually been better in terms of consistency in the Champions League than the Premier League. And I think for a couple of seasons, actually, we've seen a team that's learned how to play Champions League football. I give them last season as a pass, because that was just an exceptional Real Madrid team in terms of its ability to find results in any circumstances. They did it not just to City, but but to Chelsea and obviously at Liverpool. So I didn't see last season as a continuum of, you know, the City can't do it in Europe, Pep Guardiola can't do the Champions League narrative. I think they've got there as a really reliable Champions League team, and I think they are favourites. I don't think they should shy from that. They should embrace that. They should expect to win it. They should have those expectations. I think, going back to our conversation about Haaland, I think that's the mentality that he's trying to exude. It does feel a slightly more open year because, you know, City are favourites and they're a team that hasn't won it before. So there's an openness to that. And, you know, Napoli are the outstanding, you know, newcomers, X factor in the competition. And then you look at Bayern and Real Madrid, and nobody's making the most incredible convincing case. But put City against any other team and you don't think that other team's favourites to win the game, you'd think it'd be City. So they have to believe in that. And I suspect this is the year they'll do it.
We also saw things in this game that you'll never see in the Premier League, like a team playing a high line at the start, and Nathan Ake played two balls in behind for Haaland, actually found Haaland's runs in behind, which rarely happens in the Premier League. Part of that is because, as I say, teams don't afford them that opportunity very often. So there is something about the sort of stature and quality of the opposition who are not going to be so kind of submissive and sit back and try and hit them in a counter or soak up pressure. You know, that may well be to City's advantage. So I kind of agree. I think this team are better placed to go far in the Champions League than they have been before, really.
I think that's an interesting one for me. I think there's weaknesses in this Manchester City team, as we've seen plenty of times so far in the Premier League. And I know there might be a slightly different tactical setup. I know they've got a fantastic squad. I still think they're susceptible, and I still think that the Champions League has something over City. It's an intangible for me. I can't understand why we just at times, even in the final, for example, you know, games where they've absolutely dominated one leg, you know, a huge comeback for Real Madrid last year. We've seen better City teams than this not win the Champions League. Let's put it that way. Granted, we may have seen a stronger field in the Champions League. And I'm not going to say they're not one of the favourites, but I still think we're going to have to see something different. Even after the 7-0, we're going to have to see something better from Manchester City if they're going to win the Champions League. I'm not going to say they can't do it, because they clearly can, but, you know, sounds weird to say after a 7-0, I still think all-round performance against, you know, one of the best teams in Europe, you know, they haven't had that in the key matches, and they'll need to. I still think they will need to do that if they're going to win the Champions League, but there you go. We shall see what Guardiola and his team do. Very, very good night, obviously, for Erling Haaland, so congratulations to him. Let's talk about Liverpool next, though. Jurgen Klopp, quite philosophical after their Champions League exit. He does say they have a massive task to be back in the competition next year. Big defeat over the two legs, if you like. 5-2 in the first leg at Anfield. Karim Benzema's late goal at the Bernabeu made it Liverpool's biggest ever Champions League aggregate defeat. Liverpool were winners in 2019. They, of course, were runners-up last year, and they might not even be in the Champions League next season unless their form picks up. Although, they are 6 points behind fourth-place Spurs with a game in hand, so it's not exactly a mountain to climb at this point in time, but I know a lot of people are concerned with how Liverpool have been playing. And I think it has been seen as a transitional time for Liverpool. But as the season's worn on, Johnny, I think people have looked at the squad and thought, even though we've signed some good players, there still needs to be a bit of a mini overhaul, particularly of the midfield, certain positions where Liverpool need to strengthen. And you're almost wondering if Klopp is going to force the club's hand to be able to do that, and if this summer they are going to kind of rejuvenate that side. How much do you think they need it?
The more the season's worn on, the more obvious it becomes. And Klopp, actually, it was missed at the time, but at the end of last season, before the Champions League final, Klopp was talking about building a new team. He's seen this coming. He didn't have the money to do it last year. He needs to be able to do it this year. It's as simple as that. I think today there's been indication that Oxlade-Chamberlain will follow Roberto Firmino in leaving. I think Naby Keita is another one that's very likely to leave. There's a few players around the fringes of that squad who may possibly move on as well. You think of your Curtis Jones or your Phillips Williams. maybe Joel Matip, it's time for him to move as well. You're starting to talk about a real overhaul, and of course it centres on what they do in midfield. I think that is the crux. You know, going in against Real Madrid when you're trying to overturn that kind of deficit at the Bernabeu with a midfield of Fabinho and James Milner, to me, said everything really about where Liverpool are. The complicated thing for them is that they're not alone in looking to refresh and spend money. They'll face a Manchester City who keeps spending. They'll face a Man United that will keep spending. Goodness knows what Chelsea are going to do, but you can't rule out another splurge. And what they did last year clearly was, with limited resources, decided to target the top end of the pitch and refresh the forward line. And this summer, the midfield's a project. I think there's a worry about them forward reinforcements that they brought in. I think £160 million when you add up Jota, Diaz, Nunes and Gakpo. And that worry is simply that none of these are bad players. They're good players, but they're trying to replace what is one of the best forward lines we've ever seen in English football. And simply, they're trying to be as good as Mane and Firmino in his prime and Salah when the other two were working with them. And Nunes, I keep coming back to Nunes. I think a lot of people come back to Nunes. You can see the player that's there, and you can see the potential. You can see why they've bought him. But the reality is, if Liverpool have bought a player that still needs time, he still needs a couple of years, I think. And he's 24. You know, he's approaching 24. He's 23, but approaching 24. You know, he's older than Haaland. He's the same age. He's more or less the same age as Mbappe and Osimhen. He has got the ability to get into the real elite band, but he's not there yet. So, and Gakpo needs time as well. So what they've done is they've left themselves without, you know, they need to, at the same time as transitioning, buying new midfielders, they need to also work on adapting the expensive forwards they've invested in. And all of that adds up to a period where you see there's no quick fix for Liverpool, that it's going to be a period of flux. And even if they have a good window and buy Jude Bellingham in the summer, I don't think that automatically transforms them back into title contenders. I think this is more likely to be a further year of transition for Liverpool, whatever they do in that window.
Yeah, I mean, some are kind of saying this might be the end of what could have been a huge dynasty, which I kind of think is maybe a little bit premature. I do think there are some good players at Liverpool, and you've mentioned them already, Johnny, but some are asking after this game, has Jurgen Klopp been too loyal to some of the older players in his squad to keep them there for so long and not, you know, go for youth and regeneration a little bit earlier on? And I'll ask again, if Klopp really needs to force the hand of the club, a bit like he did with Van Dijk and Alisson, you know, bringing in two key players, does he really need to try and force the hand of a club, which may change hands, which may see big new investment come in, but that to get him the players that he really needs to take this team forward? Ian, what do you think?
Certainly they need to recruit. If anyone's going to have the authority to loosen the purse strings, it will be Klopp, and you would trust his vision of what this team needs. He's been ruthless in the past. He's been ruthless in his career. So I think the over loyalty thing is sometimes a bit exaggerated, and it tends to get attached to managers who've been at the same club for a long time, because they develop a very deep knowledge of what players are capable, but that doesn't mean they're being overly affectionate or sentimental towards them.
Yeah, I don't think he's been over loyal. I think Milner's the kind of freak of nature still to be playing at this level at that, you know, when he needs to be called upon. And look, obviously Klopp would rather not to have to call upon him. And elsewhere, you know, still the kind of elder statesmen we're getting towards Salah, and Fabinho's had a really bad year. Like, he's 29. I looked at that, I said a few weeks ago that I was thinking he looked like his legs have gone a little bit, but I don't think that can be the case. I just think that they need impactful signings. Like, you know, Johnny's absolutely bang on. There's been a lot of signing and recruitment, you know, with kind of development and the future in mind. And it looked for so long as though the evolution of Liverpool's front three was going to be really smooth. And then Sadio Mane said he wanted to leave. And then suddenly it looked like these players who were brought in to kind of, you know, slowly find a way into Liverpool's team had to be ready to live up to something extraordinary very quickly. And while all that was going on behind them, the kind of the energy in midfield of previous seasons, the kind of bedrock of Van Dijk at the back, that started to kind of to crumble a little bit. So it's all, you know, there's been a lot of issues for Liverpool this year, but what they undoubtedly need are a couple of impactful signings, I think, at centre half and in centre midfield. And I think otherwise, there's still this is still a squad with like room for development and is capable of competing at the top end of Europe and the top end of the Premier League. I think it's a couple of really big signings that would bring them back to that level.
Are we all kind of at the feeling now that Liverpool are a little bit off being a side, and I don't mean this season, over the next couple of seasons, that will challenge for the biggest titles, a Premier League title, a Champions League title? Or do we feel like if, as Gregor mentioned there, they get a couple of key players, they can still be that team? It's just an off season, Ian?
No, I wouldn't be as hasty as that, actually. I think, you know, I think the cumulative fatigue issue has been very apparent, you know, from last season's exhausting schedule and coming into this dislocated Winter World Cup season. So I think that's a factor, and you would imagine that will be eased by August, September. And yeah, you know, but you don't want to put everything on a missing person, but you know, Luis Diaz will and should make them better. So no, I wouldn't say that we're now into a long era of managed decline at all. They've come back before from indifferent domestic seasons, and you know, basically it's a well-run club and well-managed.
So then, what next? Jonathan, I was listening to Jamie Carragher a little bit earlier on, talking about Trent Alexander-Arnold at right back, who was dribbled past 6 times in the game. That's more than any other player has been in a single match in the Champions League so far this season, if that's a stat that matters. But it was interesting to hear Carragher say that he almost feels as if Trent Alexander-Arnold's time as a Liverpool right back might be coming to an end, in terms of he's great when Liverpool are that dominant team that's going to win the biggest trophies and they're always on the front foot. He's the perfect right back for that situation. But if they're going to be a bit like his teams were, a team that is hunting down fourth place, a team that isn't necessarily one of the best around, that they need to have a more defensive right back, and that his position may be elsewhere on the pitch, which, you know, a lot of Liverpool fans say, you know, there are others, supporters of other teams who are too critical of Trent Alexander-Arnold. If you like, this is someone who loves Liverpool, saying exactly what a lot of fans and, you know, pundits and players of other clubs have been saying for quite some time. It's not really good enough at this level. So what happens next, Trent?
I understand where Carragher's coming from, in all honesty. And I was watching last night's game, expecting my phone to ping with a message from David Walsh, because me and Walsh have got an ongoing debate about Trent, where he's in the Reece James camp and I'm in the Trent camp in terms of who's a better talent. And every time Trent has an aberration, I tend to get a message from David. I didn't last. Maybe he was busy with Cheltenham, but it was a horrendous performance. And the number of times he just decided his mind seemed to be elsewhere while Vinicius Jr., who was lurking off his shoulder, was frightening. And he doesn't seem to show signs that side of his game, that ability to smell danger, which is, Carragher used to say, the importance of smelling danger as a defender, that doesn't seem to be developing in him. So I get what he's saying, that if Liverpool aren't dominating the territory and the ball, they probably do need different types of defenders. The only thing that the contrary to that is that this is a season where we've seen Zinchenko play in all sorts of areas of the pitch in an outstanding way for Arsenal. I think even developing the Guardiola idea, the fullback roaming in the midfield. Now, surely there's nobody better equipped to do that than Trent in the right team when things are going. So I do wonder if Liverpool fixed their midfield problems a little bit more and were able to play a bit higher up the pitch, whether we wouldn't be having this debate. I think Carragher's point is appropriate for right now when you're chasing fourth. But ideally, if you're building Liverpool, I don't see the harm. And in fact, I'd see the assets, the benefits. Keep Trent, dominate the ball, get him into midfield, get him to do what he's done for the last two or three years. I don't think he's lost that part of the game, but maybe we haven't, even Trent fans like me are having to accept now that he's not going to fill out as a defender. You know, he kind of is what he is for good and bad, but the good is still incredible.
I think it's worse. I think he's regressed. I think he has a bit of a complex. Like, I don't want to get too deep about it, but I think you can see, like, I've been a fullback, and there are times where he's so square on, it's like, and he's left, he's almost, as Vinicius flicks the ball past him, he's left grappling, completely square on, grappling with his arms. That's a kind of place of fear. It is, it's a place of fear. He doesn't back himself, so he wants to just play as safe as possible, and then once he's gone past him, it's like he's grappling at thin air. He's grappling at his shoulders first, then he's grappling at thin air. I think it's like the whole debate is actually, I might be wrong, but it looks to me as if it's almost got into his head. I think he's a worse defender than he was two seasons ago. And look, it's true that he's playing in a team now that's exposed more often. That's all absolutely true. But we're not just talking about positional flaws. We're talking about being able to deal with 1v1 situations against some of the best players in Europe. And he can't do it. At the moment, he can't do it, and that's a big problem. I agree. I watched this game last night, and I thought, I used to hate that whole debate about Trent Alexander-Arnold. He should be playing in midfield. He's got more to offer than a fullback. I thought, nonsense. He offers more than any fullback has ever done, like in terms of attack and output. But now I think it might be the best way forward, simply because he's not got the tools to do the other side of the game, and you need to have them at the top level. So it is an interesting time for Trent Alexander-Arnold. And look, if Liverpool are firing on all cylinders again, the debate about this would quieten a little bit again. But I still think, fundamentally, when it comes to defending in those 1v1 situations, he's not got it.
I was listening to Gregor. I was remembering the opening game of the season, actually, when I had the privilege of sitting next to Gregor for Liverpool's first Premier League game at Craven Cottage. And I was there, you know, typing away, and I just got this little nudge to me, and I thought about a goal kick, you know, defending the Hammersmith end, and Gregor said, look where Trent is, and sure enough, he was nearer to Hammersmith roundabout than his own goal. So I do know that Gregor observes Trent very closely and obviously brilliantly. I just wanted to ask Gregor and Johnny, there used to be the theory that Trent would evolve into a central midfielder, or, you know, to the right of midfield or something. Is that still workable? Is that a way that Liverpool solve the positional sense problem at right back, but also solve the midfield rebuild that they are going to have to do?
I think it is workable, actually, Ian. And there's no one's better placed to help that transition than Pep Linders, who at youth team level was the coach that was playing him as a number six. And it was only when he stepped into the first team environment that he went to right back. So if they're going to, you know, with Fabinho declining and with Thiago maybe as another one who maybe come to the end of his time, then yes, that might be a logical conclusion. I guess what you're turning your back on, though, is what I mentioned earlier, which is that idea that the one of your fullbacks can be the guy that gives you one, you know, different shape, building up than out of possession, which is an idea that's been exploited so well by other coaches. If you turn your back on that and go some more traditionally, then yeah, I mean, he's always looked like he could play there, and it is a slight curiosity to me that Klopp hasn't tried it a bit more.
Absolutely bang on about the whole kind of Zinchenko idea, and there was moments in the first half where he did actually drift into that inside midfield position. The only thing is, if that's a kind of, fundamentally, that means changing the way Liverpool play, and it also would reduce what Andy Robertson offers on the other side. So that's a kind of a bigger question about how Liverpool want to play. And the point that Ian made at Fulham, it's true, he plays in a kind of pretty unique team. That was Trent closing down, I think, Anthony Robinson, the left back, like from a goal kick. So he is asked to push so high, and he's left exposed. But when all that's said and done, it's still the fundamental aspect of being a fullback is sometimes you, the winger, the player you're asked to face up, gets the ball in a bit of space and he runs at you. And when that situation occurs now, there is very little faith in Trent Alexander-Arnold stopping that winger or stopping the cross or not being beaten. And that also spreads through the team, through your teammates. Other people try and get closer to try and, you know, to try and cover him, and that creates space elsewhere. So it's an issue, and that I just haven't seen enough evidence in those situations that Trent Alexander-Arnold is a good enough 1v1 defender.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, let's have a quick look at the names in the hat for tomorrow's draw, Friday morning. So we are speaking on Thursday morning. Bayern are in, the only German side there. There's Benfica of Portugal, Chelsea, Inter Milan, Manchester City, AC Milan, Napoli and Real Madrid. Ian, three Italian sides into the Champions League quarterfinals for the first time since the 2005-2006 season. How big is that for football in Italy? Can they possibly win it as well?
Yep, three Italian clubs, four Italian managers. We're back in the old days. Yeah, no, I think there's a fair amount of self-congratulation. There's quite a lot of joy as well in a lot of the country that Juventus aren't one of those clubs. Yeah, the interesting thing is how many goals did these Italian clubs concede in the last 16 stage between them? And the answer is zero. So we really are back in the old days. Although we're not actually in the way that they're playing. Serie A is a pretty entertaining league these days, as most observers will know. I don't think AC Milan are going to win the Champions League. I don't think Inter are either, but I genuinely think that we have a very good chance of getting a new name on the cup. Now, we say that's regularly because City and PSG are usually in the mix at this stage, but I think Napoli really, really do have a chance if they continue to play the way they are. If they don't get big injuries, they can really pace themselves because they're so clear at the top of Serie A. So they have all but won the domestic title. And you know, they really are fabulous to watch. They know what they're good at, and they really do tear teams apart. So, yeah, I think Napoli really are, all things being equal, in with a shout, provided that they avoid City principally, possibly Bayern Munich in the next round.
Ian, are Bayern up for the task, do you think? In terms of winning it, I think people were impressed with how they dealt with Paris Saint-Germain. I'm yet to see a side a bit like Manchester City that I think, you know, they are definitely going to win it. And of course, we know there's potential there. What are you making of their season so far?
Well, they found it both perplexing in terms of, I guess, management issues, and unusually stressful in terms of winning the title, which they would still be favourites for. But it, you know, it has got quite tight at the top, so that's taking a bit more out of them. And you know, you can go through it. They're missing their captain and goalkeeper because he decided to go skiing after the World Cup. There's been all sorts of sort of off-field fireworks. As you say, not just their management of Paris Saint-Germain in the first knockout round, but the way they've mastered the group stage. They do know how to deal with this competition. And yes, while there are flaws, and you can sometimes see that they might be missing Lewandowski, they've got really good strength in depth, and they've got a bit of pace. And when that midfield axis of Kimmich and Goretzka functions, it's quite difficult to get through. So, I would certainly put them behind City in terms of their credentials and potential to go all the way, but not that far behind.
Benfica, a dark horse in this? I know some have said that to me previously. Do you think they can do something special this year?
They already are doing something special this year. Their record across competitions is spectacular, and when you think that they're doing this without Enzo Fernandez, it's really impressive. A dark horse, perhaps not much more than that. You have a scenario where the semi-finals are going to look, quite fresh potentially if were Benfica to beat, to come up against Napoli, for instance. We'd have a name that we don't often see at that stage, and certainly have never seen with Napoli. So it's easy to say this, but it does look a bit refreshed and open.
I've got to say, I've made my own draw just before we started the podcast. If you're listening on Friday, this is not the real draw for the Champions League. We're speaking 24 hours before it's been made. Let me make that very clear. But I went on something called randomresult.com. So if this is exactly the same tomorrow, then UEFA use it as well, okay? Because I've got Milan against Chelsea, Man City against Bayern, Real Madrid against Benfica, and Napoli against Inter. That is the way this random generator has seen the quarterfinal draws go. And to be honest, I think the quarterfinal draw of the Champions League is probably the best one around, in my opinion, just because... Mm. You usually get some really mouth-watering ties. Obviously, when you get to the semi-final, it's all there for you in terms of what you think might happen, and maybe it's not as exciting. This one, as the names get pulled out of the hat, you're like, wow, what a tie. So really looking forward to it, and we'll see who the teams get tomorrow. But I would be devastated if I had to watch Milan play Chelsea on another two occasions. So hopefully that does not happen again. A bit of a European special this time around. I want to talk to you guys about a piece that you can read in the Times. Our writers have shared their memories of some of the best individual virtuoso performances on the big stage in the Champions League of the modern era. Some of the best individual performances from the likes of Roy Keane, Steven Gerrard, for example, Wayne Rooney, and Gregor Robertson. No, not Gregor Robertson, but Gregor Robertson, you have chosen. An unlikely name.
Look, I'm standing by it too. I went for David Marshall for Celtic in 2004 in a UEFA Cup last 16 game against Barcelona at the Nou Camp. And the reason I went for it is, look, there are undoubtedly better players and better performances in this list, which is great fun. I would urge anyone to go and read it. But I don't think any of them changed the player's life quite so profoundly as it did for David Marshall, because this is a guy who, it was 3 weeks after his 19th birthday, and in the first leg, Rab Douglas was mistakenly sent off. Rab Douglas, the Celtic goalkeeper, was mistakenly sent off following like a half-time fracas in the tunnel. He was actually just trying to restrain Bobo Baldi, and if anyone remembers Bobo Baldi, that was no mean feat. So he was sent off, and so Marshall played the second 45 against Barca in the first leg and kept a clean sheet, and they went through with a 1-0 lead. But that meant he was playing. It was his second ever start. His first start was a League Cup game against Partick Thistle at Fir Hill. And as I say, he was 3 weeks after his 19th birthday. And he put in the performance of his lifetime, of his entire lifetime, of any moment, any game still to come. And that includes the penalty save against Serbia, which will always be remembered very fondly for sending Scotland to the Euros. Martin O'Neill said afterwards that his teammates gave him a standing ovation in the changing room, and he said, "It's all downhill from here. You should pack it in and retire tonight." And I don't think he was far wrong, because this, honestly, save after save, 90 minutes, kept a clean sheet against a team with Xavi, Puyol, Luis Enrique, Marc Overmars, Ronaldinho, like peak Ronaldinho, and save after save. My favourite was a little clip in behind by Xavi, and Luis Enrique was running through to it, and a volley from like point blank range, and he, remarkable agility to tip over the crossbar. He just would not be beaten. And that was it. He was an overnight sensation. He was into the Scotland team. He was Celtic's number one. It didn't last, but it changed his life, that game. And it's still a game that any follower of Celtic in European football remembers very fondly.
Johnny, what did you go for?
Well, I must admit, my it's a sort of lack of attention to detail on my part, because I've misread the request for this piece as best Champions League performances. So I went for Wayne Rooney in 2004 when he made his United debut. I was there that night at Old Trafford, and it's just hard to, you've got to put yourself back in that era when and who Rooney was at that point, this teenage force of nature that with whom anything seemed possible. There was a Haaland-like feeling about him, but he was a more, you know, complete player, like, should we say, at that age. It was his debut for United. He hadn't played since year 2004. He had never played in European club football before, and he scored one of the best hat-tricks you'll ever see. First, clipped into the top corner after Van Nistelrooy sent him through. Second, a bit of skill to beat the Fenerbahce captain and put the ball in the bottom corner, and then barged Ryan Giggs out of the way to bend home a free kick. And it was just one of those wow moments. I remember, you know, driving home, getting the editor on the phone at 11 o'clock at night, you know, saying, drop your plans for the rest of the week. This is what you'll be writing about for Sunday. That was incredible. But when I say lack of attention to detail, Wayne's performance is probably, you know, only the second most memorable individual performance after Peter Weir against Ipswich Town for Aberdeen in 1981. in the UEFA Cup. And it was just mesmerizing. Ipswich were the UEFA Cup holders. Bobby Robson in charge. This is Fergie's first big European triumph. And Peter Weir was just such a mercurial player. He could, on his day, was just unplayable. One of those winners. Wasn't always his day, but he took apart McMills in a way you just, you know, shouldn't happen. Doesn't happen to a 50 cap England defender. Just couldn't get near him, went outside and went inside and scored from the edge of the box a couple of times. Did the same to Manny Couts in the European Super Cup a few years later. So there was more. So I'd say those two are the most memorable. In all honesty, the best is probably Messi in 2011 at Wembley. But in terms of just wow moments that I'll never forget, it was Peter Weir number one, Wayne Rooney number two, Messi number three.
Ian, can you pick one?
Yeah, I didn't get the call up for this project, but
it's ridiculous, to be honest.
And this may surprise you, because sometimes he's criticised, and sometimes by me. Neymar, in that astonishing Barcelona comeback against Paris Saint-Germain, 2017, when they had a 4-goal deficit from the first leg and won 6-1. At Camp Nou, it was his leadership. He absolutely took hold of that team and made them believe in the possible. I mean, he was immensely skilled as well. He was in the referee's ear occasionally, but that was why Neymar is one of the great outstanding talents of his generation. And you know, regrettably, we don't always see that. But this really was. Neymar in excelsis, and of course it changed the shape of football, because PSG then triggered his enormous buyout clause that summer, because they said, right, this is the footballer who wins the Champions League. You know, the economics of the game have never been the same since, and sadly Neymar has perhaps not been the same since often enough, but he was magnificent that night.
Hugh, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, my personal one is Roy Keane against Juventus, which is obviously laid out in the piece. But you know, was still that era of year after year, Manchester United, you know, basically being the team for England that flies the flag in the Champions League. And it was always incremental steps. Can they go one further? Can they go one further? They'd put in big performances against big teams. Hadn't always gone through. There was always a leg away from home, maybe, that was going to be the one that was going to cost Manchester United. But yeah, Keane basically dragged Manchester United through that tie. And in that game in particular was sensational. Obviously, as we all know, it, you know, probably went down as his greatest 90 minutes, but certainly very, very memorable for all Manchester United fans that were around, obviously, at that time and watching, you know, basically take on a Juventus side. And, it, you know, there were a few games like this. You know, we got past Barcelona as well, and it was like, wow, did Manchester United really do that? And that's what it felt like against Juventus. And there were a few good performances, very good performances on that evening, but yeah, Roy Keane's leadership, I think, shone out. So it has to be that, really. I can't think of another that really, really stands out. Thierry Henry quite a few times probably for Arsenal over the years in European competition, maybe against Real Madrid, nonchalantly dribbling through towards the corner and scoring that individual goal is just incredible. So maybe something like that. But yeah, I mean, for a Man United fan, it's got to be Keane. So there you go. Gentlemen, been a pleasure to catch up and speak about Europe. So thank you so much for joining me. Thank you all for listening as well. Make sure you check us out on Monday. The game will be out, of course, on Monday. So make sure you pick up a paper then, or make sure you're subscribed online, thetimes.co.uk/thegame. Another big weekend of football ahead of us, including the FA Cup quarterfinals. We'll be back on Monday to react to all of that. We'll see you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.